I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of October. The presidential news conference went very long. I think it's unusual for him to have a press conference that lasted over an hour. So our programming was preempted. The subject of his press conference has been the focus of many of our recent programs. So we will, in the days ahead, be dissecting the government shutdown, the possible default on the debt with a variety of guests. But we didn't want to miss an opportunity to present the people who had been scheduled for this full hour. At least we'll be with them for about a half hour today. They're the son and daughter of Leon Lason. Their father died in January at the age of 83, but his story will live. His recently published memoir is The Boy on the Wooden Box, How the Impossible Became Possible on Schindler's List. Leon's father convinced Oskar Schindler to let Leon, who was very young at the time, to work in Schindler's factory. And the title of the book comes from the fact that Leon was so small that he had to stand on a box to work the machinery. His son and daughter are with us this hour to talk about their father's extraordinary life. Stacy Lason Wilfong is joining us. Hello, Stacy. Thank you so much for being with us. Hi, Stacy.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for waiting as we listen to the press conference as well. And Daniel, thank you so much for being with us. Hello. Daniel, are you there? Well, I'm not sure where Daniel is, but we will begin then with Stacy. Stacy, I'm wondering, the story is just so incredibly hopeful and terribly awful at the same time. I'm wondering how long it was before you knew much of anything about your father's life.
Well, we always knew the general story. We knew that there was an Oskar Schindler who had saved his life and his family's. The details, though, only came out after Schindler's List, the movie.
Because your father didn't want to talk?
Right. He didn't. Well, first of all, you know, when he first got to the United States, he didn't feel like people would understand and were ready to hear. And then as we grew up, he really didn't. He felt like it would have been a burden to us. And so he really just didn't want to share and burden us with something like that.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, are you with us now? Daniel, hello? I don't know where he is. We'll just keep trying to find him.
Okay.
I understand that he started speaking, what, in 1994, was it? And then he really started speaking. He was speaking at least once a week.
Yeah. You know, once he started speaking, once somebody finally convinced him, his speeches were so compelling and so heartfelt and so sincere and so well done, really, that audience members always would come to him and say, would you come to speak to my other group? Or word of mouth, you know, we heard that you have a story that we'd like to share with our group. Would you be willing? And it went by word of mouth. And he, you know, he wasn't trained. He wasn't a professional speaker. He didn't have any history of that except being a high school teacher. But I heard him a few times. I had moved away, married, and gone. But I heard him speak a few times, and it was just so, he was so good at it because he was being sincere and speaking from the heart.
Yeah. There are so many things striking about his story, but it's interesting he became a teacher because he essentially had to quit school at the age of 12. And at first, I'm sure, even though the circumstances of his life were incredibly trying, which is an understatement, the fact that he couldn't go to school, oh, I don't have to school, and then the fact that he couldn't go to school made him aware of all the horrors around him, because what else are you going to do? You lose your childhood at the age of 12.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a big difference between I don't have to go to school and I can't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that he became a teacher also because he taught industrial arts and machine shop, and he was just really interested in technology. And it's interesting to read the story and see when the first light bulb came to his town, and then, you know that what he taught and what he learned and what he was interested in, computers and machines and all that technological stuff.
Mm-hmm. He was also remarkable at languages, as your brother would say, if we can link with him, that he spoke so many languages and just had a gift for taking them on, didn't he?
He did. He had a gift for it. And he would learn a new language fairly accent-free, as evidenced by his English, which was very accent-free.
Mm-hmm. And he spoke Russian, and he spoke Hungarian, and he spoke he spoke all kinds, a little bit of Japanese, a little bit of Spanish.
Right. He was willing to learn anything anybody would teach him. And he also could understand. You know, he just had an affinity for understanding a foreign language.
Mm-hmm. Daniel?
Yes, I'm
here.
Oh,
there we go. Okay. Hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for being with us. Your sister, we've been speaking with her for a few minutes while we were trying to establish connection. Tell us how, and this, it's almost fortuitous, isn't it? The fact that he was able to live, the fact that Schindler saved him, because there was so much separation among his family members, his mother and his brothers and his sister and his father, that it was just miraculous, really, that he was able to get into the factory. Can you tell us that story?
Are you talking to me, Daniel?
Yes, yes, Daniel.
Yes, you know, when the workers were being finally designated to work in Schindler's factory, Amalia, which was being relocated outside of the Plaszow camp. My dad and his mother and sister were supposed to be on the list, and he had been informed by his boss that his name was marked off the list for some reason. We don't know why, but my dad thinking that if the rest of the family was going to Schindler's factory and he was going to be left behind, that would probably be the end for him. So he decided that he would go to the, I guess, the train depot where people were being loaded onto trains. And that's the moment where he approached a Nazi guard and said to him, I'm on the list and my name has been crossed off. And to kind of do this to a Nazi soldier who really, you know, the behavior was so unpredictable at that point. And my dad talks about only being able to see his Nazi belt buckle, and he showed the list where his name was. And for some reason, the soldier said, okay. And he said, yes, you are. And he put him in the group that was leaving.
There are so many moments like that in his whole story, aren't there, Daniel, that you almost feel that he was marked to be a blessed person because it so easily could have gone another way.
Yes. I mean, moment after moment, and it's hard to really understand why, or but you know, my dad was a charismatic guy, and he's well liked by everyone who met him, and I think maybe some of that he just had a nice, easygoing way about him, and I don't know, maybe that was the reason. But you know, I'm certain that there were a lot of people who were charismatic that didn't make it through, and there's a lot of just plain luck involved.
Yeah,
for sure.
He tells a story in the book, Stacy, and I think that he describes this, although he didn't know what was ahead, that this may indeed have been one of the worst days of his life when one evening, without warning, two members of the Gestapo burst through the front door of their apartment in Krakow and humiliated and beat his father. What a horrible thing to have to witness.
Absolutely, and unbearably horrible, and they all had so much respect for their father and what he was doing for them and taking care of the family in the worst of times and doing the best he could. And there was so much love there. And to see that it's difficult for a child.
I would imagine. At this point, how were they living, Daniel? They were in a ghetto in Poland, in Krakow?
At the point when the soldiers barged in?
Yes.
I believe that they were in the ghetto at that point, and they were living in an apartment that was in really cramped quarters and separated by a sheet that was hung up, you know, to divide the room in half with another family, and living in terrible, cramped condition. And that was what was going on.
Mm-hmm. He had a chance. The book begins, Stacy, where he is meeting Schindler. I believe it's so many years later, and he is worried that Schindler will have no idea who this person is. Your father is now 35 years old, but the remarkable thing is that Schindler remembered him.
Yeah, it was in 1965 at Los Angeles Airport, and my father was with his parents, who were also on Schindler's list, and a few other Schindler survivors, and who, you know, you would imagine they looked more like they had since they were adults at the time and continued to be an adult. And mm-hmm. he, that was although he didn't share many details with us growing up, that was one story that was really important to him, that Schindler remembered and recognized him for who he was. But also I noticed looking back, and we've uncovered some old photographs, and, you know, in the last, you know, little bit of time, we've been looking at a lot of old pictures, and he really looked very similar, and he had a very open face, very, you know, he had a smile that you kind of remembered, and I could see how even if he were 15 years old, he would be recognizable at 35.
And Stacy, and I'm interested in your response to this too, Daniel, how would both of you describe, and how did your father describe, who Schindler was?
Dan, you want to go?
You know, my dad described him as an entrepreneur and a very social guy who was looking for a business opportunity in in what was going on in Poland at that time, and he describes in the book of how he really enjoyed his nightlife, and he was a smooth talker and an entrepreneur, and I think that there was maybe a shift in his view of what was going on once he got to Poland and saw what was really happening.
And what was it? What was that shift, Stacy?
Well, I would say, you know, my father always made an effort to make it clear that Oskar Schindler was a man, and he wasn't perfect. He wasn't an angel. He was a man, and he enjoyed his drinks, and he maybe enjoyed some other things. But when it came to humanity and making the right choice, he put his own life in danger to do what was the right thing, and that was to rescue people and shield them from the horrific possibility of what was going on around them, which was unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are a lot of good people, but not everybody has the character strength to make that kind of choice.
Daniel, because of what your father had lived through, did he fashion you and your sister's life in any special way? I mean, was there something about that experience that influenced what kind of father he was?
Absolutely, yes. And the way that he shaped our lives was, you know, his quote is that he wanted to give us a legacy of freedom, not a legacy of fear. And I know, I'm speaking for myself, I feel like I lived a pretty normal American suburban youth existence without living in the shadow of my father's history or the Holocaust or any of the horrors that happened. And I think that was really how it affected my dad, that he wanted to make sure that, you know, none of this affected us. And it, although we were made, you know, aware of the story and everything, it wasn't something that was dominating our lives all the time.
Mm-hmm. How can
You can speak for me. I agree with that. And I'd also like to say that he wanted to leave a legacy not of fear. And I don't know about you. I won't speak for you, but I always felt safe. And I think that the childhood he had where he never felt safe, right. I think it's really impressive that he managed to raise a child who always felt safe. I never felt in danger. Of course, not in the same kind of danger he was in, of course, but even so.
And it is amazing that he was able to do that because fear was so much a part of his childhood. I mean, he writes about what the Germans were doing and the Germans invading Poland, and he was just a kid, for heaven's sake. So that childhood that he had to sacrifice was completely filled by sitting around the radio early on when they could and listening to the reports on the radio and the newspapers and the Nazis and what they were doing in the streets and what they were doing to people who were on railroad cars. I mean, it was everywhere, and it was horrendous.
And it was completely unpredictable.
Yes.
Based on what their relationship with the German soldiers had been in years past when they'd maybe been invaded, they couldn't predict from day to day how much can it, you know, could it get worse? What will they think of next? And you would be in constant fear because how could you predict how much worse it could get? And every day it did get worse.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I just think that he must have, I think that my dad must have been so happy to see his children living the lives that they were leading, given the childhood that he had had. And it must have been just a very strange but happy experience for him to see his children growing up in a different way than he did and not in the shadow of all of this stuff.
I love what you say at the end of the book, that this is such a tribute to him. He pretty much taught me everything I know about anything worthwhile. I love that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's the truth. That's the truth. I misspoke earlier. The incident when the soldiers beat my grandfather was before they had moved into the ghetto. That was at the beginning of the occupation by the Nazi troops. Excuse me for that mistake.
Yeah.
But they were living in Krakow. They had moved to the city.
Yeah. We want people to read the book, and I hope many people do. It seems to be the kind of book. I'm wondering what ages you recommend this for, but it's one of those books that you never want to forget what happened and the triumph of the human soul and the story of your father you really want to live on forever. And it's. I think this book will do that, don't you? I hope it will.
Yeah, I really do. And I think although the focus of the book is for young adults, and I think that, you know, my dad would have been really, really happy to have this story being told to the young adults, because I think that that's the most impressionable age. I think it's really it's outstandingly written, and I think it's an interesting story for people of all ages. I really do.
Mm-hmm. And Stacy, you write about how generous he was with his knowledge, with his laughter, with everything. I love that description of a human being. To be generous is so important, isn't it?
I think so. And you know, I know he had, we know now, you know, his childhood was traumatic and frightening, and atrocities were committed to friends and acquaintances and family members. But I think that the way he was an adult was part of his character in spite of all that. So if none of those events had happened, I still believe that his character was formed before all of it, not in spite of it all. I mean, not because of it. You know what I mean? Not because of the events. I think we're lucky that that's the man he was.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. I know it's shortened today, but we did want to have this conversation because the book is so moving and so important, and we're delighted to have Stacy and Daniel with us. The book was written by their father. The book is The Boy on the Wooden Box, How the Impossible Became Possible on Schindler's List. He was the youngest person on Schindler's List, and he wrote his memoir. He passed away just in the past year, in January. His two children are with us now to talk about their father, Stacy Layson, Will Fong, and Daniel Layson. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our brief conversation, because the presidential news conference went very long. We didn't know that he was going to give a conference until about an hour before, and then we thought it important to carry that. So our conversation is shortened, but if you'd like to join us, okay, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We continue our conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. I just want to hear about how the book came about a little bit more. Your father really never kept notes or anything, did he? This is an accumulation of all that. I don't know if one of you was writing down what he was saying when he spoke. He spoke without notes. He spoke from memory. And the substance of the talks, I understand, were what led to the book, are the substance of the book. Daniel?
Yeah, he always spoke without notes, and he was just approached by someone to write his memoirs, and he began to write stuff down for the first time ever. And it was incredible to see him get up there and speak without notes and relive these horrors. But it had such a deep effect on so many people that I feel like he understood that it was an important thing to do, and thankfully he took the time to write this stuff down, and then everything kind of went from there.
And Stacy, what kind of effect did it have on you to hear all these stories? He was your dad.
Also, I want to say he also had some help writing it. There was a woman named Sophie Sartain who spoke to him and kind of wrote everything he said and helped him organize it into a cohesive story.
Hmm.
So it wasn't just cobbled together from his speeches. He also sat down and went through everything in an order.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it like hearing those stories? It was remarkable because, as I said, we knew the basic framework, but the details. And for him, you know, he put his hat on the train and then left it behind him when he came to the United States. in the story. I don't know if you remember that part in the book. And he always said that he, you know, he had one life and then he came to the United States and started a second. So for me, hearing those stories, it's a little bit like hearing them about someone else, you know, besides the man that I grew up with.
Yeah. And they were in your mother and father, and I can't remember who else was in a displaced persons camp for 3 years, Daniel. That's a long time.
Yeah, that's one of the things in the book that really is mind-blowing to me, is just the length of time some of this stuff took to happen. I mean, after all of the suffering of the war, they finally, and it was his mother and father and my dad, so my grandparents and my dad, in the displaced person camp in Germany, of all places, for 3 years before they were able to figure out exactly where they were going to go, now that their roots had been torn up and their relatives were killed and they had no place to go.
Oh, my. It just kind of takes your breath away, the whole thing, doesn't it? Judy is on the phone for you. Judy in Horicon. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I just had a question. In the movie Schindler's List, there was a boy, and do you know if that character was fashioned after your dad?
Stacy?
I don't believe so. There were a group of young kids. He was not actually the youngest. He was among the youngest. It was just an amalgamation of children. It was not specifically based on him.
I see. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for calling, Judy.
And tell us the story, Daniel, of the wooden box. He really did have to stand on it to do his work. And what was the work?
Well, he was working in Schindler's factory on a machine of some sort. And he was just had been so malnourished and weakened by, you know, the lack of food and everything, that he didn't grow properly. And he was unable to reach the controls of the machine he was working on, and so he had to stand on a wooden box to reach the controls.
And tell us what happened, Stacy, to all of his siblings.
Well, he was the youngest of five, and his oldest brother, when the family was from a small country village in Poland, and they had moved to Krakow so that my grandfather could work before they were put in the ghetto. He had gone to find work. And when they heard about the troubles back home, the oldest brother had gone back because the grandparents and the aunts and uncles were all in the village. So he had gone back to kind of care for them. They later learned that some German troops, whose job it was to go and clear the Jews out of villages, had gone to that village and, you know, herded the women into one place and the men into another and just murdered them all.
Ah.
His next brother, his most beloved brother, who's written extensively about in the story, had gone to the ghetto with them, met a girlfriend, and then during the changes of the transports between leaving the ghetto and the factory moving to Czechoslovakia, there was an exchange on a train where, in the movie in Schindler's List, Schindler went to the train station to rescue his accountant. And on that transport was also my uncle. And Schindler ran across him and said, come with me. Come, your family is, you know, I can take you. And he said, I'm with my girlfriend. Can you bring her? And Schindler said, no, I can't take her. And he said, well, I'll stay with her. And that train went off, and that was the last they know of him.
Yeah.
And he also had another brother and a sister who are now in Israel. So they came along, they ended up in the displaced persons camp with the family. And when my father and his parents decided to emigrate to the United States, the older brother and sister went to Palestine.
Mm. Was your father hopeful that he was the one who would be doing all of these interviews, Daniel?
I don't really know. I think that he would have been happy to do them, to be honest with you. He was, like my sister says, a very generous guy, and I don't think that he wished for them or hoped for them in any way.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been very humbled by really what a great book this is, and the fact that his story is actually in print. I think he would have been amazed by it, and I think he would have done basically anything anybody any interview that anybody asked him to do. I don't think that he wished for it at all. He was very humble.
Yeah, I think that he would have been pretty darn proud of both of you. I can tell that he raised two pretty good kids, didn't he, Stacy?
Oh, thanks, Kathleen.
Well, really, really.
Try.
Yeah,
try.
It's quite remarkable. Well, it's a book that should be read by everybody, and I'm sorry our time was cut short, but the government is shut down, and the president had to talk. You never know, right? Thank
I've
you.
I've never been preempted by Obama before, so.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was pretty neat.
There's a story you can tell. At least we right. made it on the air. Thank you both so much. All the best to you and to your families. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kathleen.
The book is The Boy on the Wooden Box, How the Impossible Became Possible on Schindler's List. It's a memoir by Leon Lacen. Unfortunately, he died in January of 2013, but we had the pleasure of speaking to his son and daughter, Stacy Lacen Wilfong and his son, Daniel Lacen. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. A reminder, Central Time is coming up in just a moment. They'll be talking with a frontline producer and reporter about the effects of concussions and other brain injuries on professional football players. After 3 o'clock, the documentary League of Denial airs on PBS affiliates at 8 o'clock tonight, Tuesday, October 8th. We're with you again tomorrow. Reminder, Bill McKibben, author of Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist, Hour 2. And then we'll talk about the new beautiful exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum. So that's coming up tomorrow. News, I'm sure there will be reports on what the president had to say and more coming up now from NPR.